The Irish Independent publishes details of a briefing document for the new Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, which predicts that massive backlogs for basic treatment and diminished cancer services will be left in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. Cormac McQuinn reports that the 209-page briefing contains a warning that patient waiting lists will increase by as much as 130%. It also details how work on the second CAT lab in Waterford has been delayed and predicts a €180 million euro shortfall in funding for the National Children's Hospital. The Irish Times gives front page coverage to the heavy toll that COVID-19 has taken on Ireland's economy, as revealed in the latest Exchequer figures, which show it punched an €8.3 billion hole in the public finances. The paper says some ministers have privately expressed concern about the Cabinet's response to the pandemic and have questioned the messaging coming from the Department of the Taoiseach. We're told a number of ministers singled out the decision not to reopen pubs and said a plan to support the sector should have been devised and published alongside Tuesday's announcement that they wouldn't be reopening. Two tests for all tourists is the Irish Daily Mail's lead headline. In an interim report, the Oireachtas Committee on COVID-19 recommends that all overseas visitors who come into the country be tested at least twice during their stay in Ireland, and it also calls for a tightening of quarantine regulations. The Irish Examiner brings us details of how a potential ecological disaster on the west coast was averted when the Naval Service intervened to prevent a cargo vessel laden with oil from crashing against rocks near Slinehead in County Galway. Ellie Neave responded to a request for help on Tuesday morning from the crew of Aqua Transporter, which was carrying 32,000 cubic tonnes of oil after it had lost power and was drifting towards rocks. The death of a teenager yesterday in a fall at Powerscourt Waterfall in County Wicklow was covered on the front of the Irish Daily Star. The 15-year-old, who was believed to be from Northern Ireland, was on holidays with his parents. A Coast Guard helicopter attended the scene and Gardaí have described it as a tragic accident. Irish pair in Beirut blast horror. That's the headline on the front of the Irish Daily Mirror. Two Irish people living in Beirut told of their horror at witnessing the huge explosion in the Lebanese capital. Cafe owner Niamh Fleming Farrell from County Laois was briefly knocked unconscious, while Colin Lee from Drogheda said his house had been left in ruins. The lead story for the Herald is that families of the Stardust victims say they're elated that inquests into the deaths of 48 people in the 1981 disco fire are to begin early next year. The venue will be Dublin Castle, where some preliminary hearings are expected to be held in the coming months in preparation for full sittings in 2021. There's been a concerning increase in dead animal dumping in Galway. That's covered in the Irish Farmers Journal. Local vet Rita Gately told the paper that she was regularly dealing with cases of ewes, lambs, calves and horses being dumped illegally, and she warned that a significant number had been left close to water extraction points, which had the potential to contaminate the public water supply. And there's extensive coverage in words and in pictures of the funeral of John Hume. Alison Morris writes in the Irish News that the miserable weather reflected the mood of the city, a place he loved so well and that equally loved him back. There was nothing normal about the funeral, but it was quite lovely in its simplicity, she says, a fitting end for a man whose son John Jr. rightly thanked for a life well lived.
There were 50 new cases of COVID-19 confirmed here yesterday. There were no new deaths. 81% of the new cases were in people under the age of 45. The highest number was in Wexford, which had 11 new cases. There were 10 in Kildare, 6 in Dublin, 5 in Donegal, and 18 spread across counties Carlow, Cork, Limerick, Louth, Meath, Offaly, Sligo, Tipperary and Wicklow. NPHET says that they have growing and significant concerns about the number of outbreaks in congregated settings. In a letter to the Health Minister this week, they specifically mention people living in direct provision. They say there are 235 cases, including 47 new cases and 4 new clusters in the past week alone. We are joined now by Bulalani Memfako from the Movement for Asylum Seekers in Ireland, who lives in direct provision in County Clare. Bulalani, thank you for being with us on Morning Ireland. Is there much or any overlap between these cases in direct provision and those confirmed cases among meat factory workers and healthcare workers?
It would be appear to be quite concerning for both settings, because we would know that those settings are quite an enclosed environment that has a large number of people. So you can imagine a workplace, any workplace actually, would have a significant number of people working in it. Think about a retail store, you'd have a significant amount of staff working in it, but you have huge spaces inside. In some settings, whereas in others you don't have enough space. The differences are then in network poverty incentives that people live in close quarters of each other. So you would have people living in the direct poverty center where there was an outbreak in Newbridge, three people in one bedroom, a very tiny bedroom at that, who all tested positive. None of them had any way of avoiding close contact with other people who live in the center. And so a congregated setting like that creates an environment where the virus thrives, because people don't have privacy, they don't have the personal space that is required. So when you're told that you need to keep 2 meters away from the next person, in most cases in direct provision centers where people share bedrooms, kitchens, communal toilets, there isn't that space to be able to share. There isn't even a 2 meter space between beds in some cases, and so you can't avoid close contact with other people. And so we generally would expect that such environments would have a significant number of COVID-19 outbreaks.
So Bulalani, when someone in direct provision tests positive for COVID-19, do many of those people remain living where they are, or are they removed? Are they able to quarantine? Are they taken elsewhere?
The practice is that once a person tests positive or has been identified as a close contact of a positive person, they are moved to an off-site self-isolation facility. They did try to create self-isolation spaces in direct provision centres, but that wouldn't, of course, work, because in many of the direct provision centres, you don't have cooking facilities, for instance. You don't have space to cook, you're not allowed to cook, and therefore you wouldn't be able to self-isolate, especially in cases where you have to use communal toilets, communal bathrooms, and others. So those people would have to be taken off to an off-site facility, such as the one in City West and others around the country.
And their contacts as well, people living close with them, are they removed to those self-isolation units as well?
Yes, they would be, but it's a very difficult one to ascertain, because who do you decide is a close contact to you when you live in a direct provision centre? For instance, I live in Noklesheen direct provision centre, and the capacity for Noklesheen is 250 people. Who would you decide is the close contact if I were to test positive, for instance? Is it the 18 men that I have to share a small kitchenette with, a tea making facility with? Is it my roommate who I share a bedroom with, or is it the people, or the 200 plus people that I have to go and queue for food with in the canteen? So it becomes difficult in that circumstances to decide who is a close contact. In some cases, you might just identify the roommates as the close contacts, or if people know that they have been in close contact with others. But when with the outbreaks that we've seen, such as Kahisavin, for instance, or Newbridge in Kildare, it becomes very difficult, because some of the people who were tested positive for COVID-19 in Newbridge in particular weren't at all linked with the dog and food company that had an outbreak where some of the asylum seekers were working in. So it's difficult to say where they got the COVID-19 from.
Yes. The National Public Health Emergency Team, in their letter this week to the Health Minister, also recommended testing every 2 weeks for people living in direct provision centres. Do you expect that to happen?
We expect the safety net and the HSE to be conducting regular testing once there has been a confirmed case in a direct provision centre. They usually do that. But the problem is it doesn't help us avoid further outbreaks. Because, for instance, the Department of Justice tells us that at least three people will be sharing a room. They've committed to that. What they didn't commit to was ensuring that single people have their own bedrooms and that families have their own self-contained units. Because what you do see now in direct provision centres is that children Some children have become the only members of their family who test positive for COVID-19, where the parents are negative. Nobody else is positive in the family. And that's concerning because a lot of these children don't have any private space for families. The only spaces that they would have as a private space for the family happens to be a bedroom. Every other space is communal. And in that circumstance, you can't avoid the spread of COVID-19, where people are sharing intimate living spaces. And so the decision by the Department of Justice to say that three people are okay to share a bedroom is actually not okay, because it does encourage the spread of COVID-19. And these would be different strangers who have their own life. My roommate has no idea where I am, and I don't know where he is. I can't account for his whereabouts. I shouldn't have to account for his whereabouts, and I should, okay, mention that he tell me as well where he is at. But we don't have that much control that you would have if you lived in your own home of avoiding close contact with other people.
Bulalani, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Bulalani Mfako from the Movement of Asylum Seekers in Ireland.
Anonymity for those accused of all sexual offences, not just rape, unless convicted. Free legal advice for victims of sexual offences. Training for Gardaí judges and lawyers in dealing with sex crimes. And a public education programme about consent. They're just some of the 50 recommendations made by a review of protections for vulnerable witnesses in sexual offences cases. The report was carried out by law lecturer and barrister Tom O'Malley and was commissioned by the government in the wake of the Belfast rape trial in 2018. Nolene Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Rape Crisis Centre, is on the line to look at it in more detail. Nolene, what are the, there's 50 recommendations there, what are the key areas you feel need to be implemented as a matter of priority?
Yeah, so there are maybe three or four big areas that need attention really quickly, but it's great to see them called out in this report. So the first is the whole area of information. The loneliest person on the journey to prosecution for a sexual offence is the victim of that offence, lacking knowledge, lacking information, lacking support, unless they have it from family and friends or perhaps from a supporter from a sexual violence centre. So the report is proposing general information available to people, whether they report or not. And it's also proposing that people will have access to legal advice in what is a very tricky and complex legal procedure, and where they only had the most limited of legal advice before. So information and support is a key thing. And the next area that really needs to be implemented quickly is the whole area of the delay of these cases. Because if you think about it, these are cases where very often the whole evidence of the trial is going to be around the account both of the accused and of the victim. And in these cases, both the victim then and the accused have to hold on to all of the dangerous, toxic account of a bad experience in their lives for far too long. So this report recognises that and is suggesting that what you can't solve everything, but what you could do is set out a clearer pathway before a case is set down for hearing, so that when it comes to hearing, somebody will get heard on the day. I think that question that you mentioned in the outset of anonymity in respect of all sexual assault trials is important. For the most part, we do courts in public in Ireland, but in these cases you are talking about the most intimate accounts that sometimes people wouldn't even tell their nearest and dearest, being thrashed out in open court if it's sexual assault, no longer if it's rape, but in that case it's very important. And finally, I think the other area that we hear the minister is going to announce progress on is the whole area of training of people, because one of the things that's not well understood in the legal profession, or indeed more generally, is the impact of trauma on the person who has been harmed by sexual violence. And we also have a lot of myths and ideas in our head about the ways in which a victim might be responsible for their own crime. All of them are incorrect, and because lawyers, judges, Gardaí are all part of society, everyone needs good training in that way. So what as I understand it, the minister is proposing on foot of the programme for government to build a path for implementation really quickly. So while the recommendations are there, we have known, and I mean, a lot of what's coming up now would have been included in submissions we made in the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre and elsewhere. But what's going to be really important is that those recommendations have a clear pathway to implementation.
And how important are the proposals for an application, pre-trial application, to be made to a judge to discuss a complainant's sexual history?
Yes, yeah, so that's one of the areas where, you know, a complainant can be going in, somebody who has suffered the crime can be going into court on the morning, ready to give their evidence, and at the last minute be hit by an application by the other side saying, oh, we need to introduce evidence of the complainant's previous sexual history in order to better understand the case. That is, any person, I think, listening can imagine how you know, disconcerting, to say the very least, and how horrifying, to say the most, that can be. So the pre-trial hearings are to sort out that kind of thing, to announce where, if the defendant feels it is necessary to bring in prior sexual history, that the judge can hear that in advance of the trial to identify, is it necessary? Previous sexual history is not going to be relevant in a wide number of cases, but at least deal with it offside. Deal with other issues that will come up at a later stage offside. This is, for instance, to make an analogy, if it was a commercial hearing, if it was big business, there are loads of pre-trial hearings. There are people deal with side issues ahead of the main trial, so that when the date of the main trial comes, everyone is in place, everything can go ahead.
Okay.
And somebody who has got all their courage together in order to give their evidence to a court full of strangers, for the most part, that at least they can go ahead and do that. So I think what's really important in some ways about this report is the recognition of how different sexual offences are from other kinds of crime, and how so far the victim, the most hurt person, the person who is very vulnerable, and indeed there may be other vulnerable witnesses as well, is entitled to have a hearing that allows them to tell their account accurately and fairly and without being re-traumatised.
Okay,
and
Nolene
this
Blackwell,
report will do that, provided that it is implemented.
Okay, Nolene Blackwell, sorry to cut across you. We must leave it there. We will be discussing this in more detail with the Justice Minister later on.
Lebanon has begun 3 days of national mourning following this week's explosion in the capital, Beirut. Almost 3,000 tonnes of ammonium nitrate, which had been stored for 6 years at the city's port, blew up, killing at least 137 people. Dozens are missing, thousands are injured, hundreds of thousands are homeless. A two-week state of emergency has been declared. Chloe Cornish is Middle East correspondent at the Financial Times, and she's in Beirut. Chloe, what is the latest? Are they still searching for survivors?
The searches have been ongoing for a very long time. I think that civil defence forces have started to pack up a lot in a lot of places. But we did see people make some miraculous recoveries yesterday of people who've been children who've been trapped under the rubble for up to 10 hours, sometimes more. Someone was retrieved at sea who had managed to survive the blast, which happened at Beirut's port yesterday. The day before yesterday.
And the pictures are just extraordinary of the wreckage and the devastation caused by this blast. And there must be a real sense of bewilderment and perhaps growing anger among people there.
Absolutely. The cleanup effort in a lot of neighbourhoods is being led very much by the people of those neighbourhoods. In a lot of cases, people say they feel like their government still isn't there to help them. And there is growing anger. Yesterday, we saw the former Prime Minister Saad Hariri taking a tour with his convoy in the devastated area of Beirut. And protesters actually threw rocks at that convoy. Prime Minister was at the top of the government that was toppled by wide-scale protests, which erupted in October last year. And a lot of people expect people to take to the streets again to voice their anger about what's happened here.
And a number of port officials have been placed under house arrest. Is that the case?
So the details on this are still quite hazy, but the government in a cabinet meeting yesterday stated its intention to have port officials who may have been involved in the storage of the explosive chemical compounds that caused the massive blast. The government said they wanted those people to be kept in their houses while an investigation is ongoing. But it's unclear at the moment exactly who that will be, how many port officials that will be, when the port officials will be required to stay in their houses until, and what level of official we're talking about here as well. I mean, will it just be the directors of these facilities, or will this extend further down? So things are still a bit unclear on that part of the investigation.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for bringing us up to date this morning. Chloe Cornish, who is Middle East correspondent at the Financial Times, on the latest following that explosion this week in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. You're with Morning Ireland. It's 7:30.
Petula Martin has a first look at the business headlines.
Thanks, Samantha. AIB has reported an underlying loss of €700 million for the first 6 months of the year. The bank set aside €1.2 billion to cover potential loan losses due to the impact across all portfolios caused by COVID-19. AIB is announcing a €300 million social housing fund for the provision of 2,000 new social houses. Bord Bia says a fall in food and drink exports of €126 million so far this year shows the impact of the pandemic on international trade. This is on the back of a decade of record growth, which saw €13 billion in food and drinks exports just last year. Bord Bia has designed supports to assist producers mitigate against the impact on trade. Employers are recognising the importance of supporting employees' mental health, according to research by IBEC. More businesses are seeking out ways to support employees and proactively putting measures and programmes in place to enhance overall staff well-being. On the currencies, €1 buys 90 pence sterling and $1 19 cents.
Time for the sports news. Good morning, Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Samantha. David McGoldrick has been named the Player of the Year in the three FEI International Awards. He's the first-time winner of this particular accolade. Alan Brown claimed the Young Player of the Year award. But what a year it's been for McGoldrick, who's had a terrific season for both club and country. The striker paid tribute to former Irish manager Mick McCarthy for backing him during tough times.
No, surprised. You know, I think there'll be a lot of players that could have got it for the performances for this qualifying campaign and the other games. You know, I think there's a wealth of experience and young, talented players as well. So, you know, it's a real honour and privilege to win this award ahead of them. Having a manager that trusts you and you know, selects me to play. You know, I think in previous years I've been in and out of the squads, not really getting a consistent game time, which was fair enough, which was rightly so, but you know, to get game time and to show what I can do, and obviously to win this award on at the back end of it, you know, going against the likes of Ender Stevens and Glenn Whelan, and you know, two big names there, to win it in front of them, you know, I'm proud of myself for that.
Yeah, well done to him. Well deserved as well. Manchester United came from behind to beat the Austrian side LASK in the Europa League. 2-1 on the night, 7-1 on aggregate. And United will now qualify for the Final Eight tournament in Germany. They'll take on Copenhagen, and that match will be next Monday. After the match, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the manager, confirmed that Alexis Sanchez, his loan move to Inter Milan, will be made permanent today. Now, the US PGA Championship gets underway later on. It's been a funny sort of period for the golf, hasn't it? No fans. This lockdown has really taken its toll, but it's great to have the action back. And this is the first major in about 12 months. It will be a little bit different. Greg Allen looks ahead to the action.
Because it's the first major golf championship to be played in over a year, this US PGA enjoys a level of anticipation that actually it probably has never enjoyed before. Even with a slew of COVID-19 related withdrawals, a former champion Paddy Carrington among them, about 90% of the world's top 100 players will compete at Harding Park, where the last man to win a major, Shane Lowry, has been drawn nice and favourably in the first two rounds with the reigning US Open champion Gary Woodland and the defending US PGA champion Brooks Koepka. Kepka, incidentally, going for three in a row, something that hasn't been done in the USPGA in almost 100 years. They'll be on the course at 10 past four this afternoon, Irish time, in what will be a spectator-free environment. And this, of course, is the new normal, as they say, and Lowry is now well used to it.
You know, will it be the same as if there were 40,000 people out there? No, absolutely not, but everybody knows how much these tournaments mean and everybody knows how much they want to win one of these things. So, you know, if we can roll a few putts in early this week and get a bit of confidence going, you never know what could happen.
On the course just after 4:30 this afternoon will be Rory McIlroy in a stellar looking three ball with Tiger Woods and the world number one Justin Thomas. Since the resumption of the PGA Tour since lockdown, McIlroy has registered just one top 30 finish in five events and not a single top 10, and he's admitted that he's missed the fans.
You know, I've said in the last few weeks that I've struggled to adapt to it, but you know, I think we're just lucky that we're able to play golf tournaments at this point.
McIlroy and Shane Lowry among the early starters in the field. Graham McDowell has a late start of 9:25 this evening alongside Matthew Wolfe and Bubba Watson.
Action also on the European Tour. Three Irish in the field at the English Championship. Stephanie Meadow competing in the Marathon Classic in Ohio. Martin Gould beats Steve Maguire 10-3 in the first round of the snooker. Mark Williams leads 5-3 over Stuart Bingham in round two. And finally, there's racing at Leopardstown today from 1 o'clock.
And the coronavirus is continuing to have a huge impact on the US presidential election in November. Joe Biden will not accept his party's nomination at the Democratic convention in Wisconsin this month, and President Donald Trump has said he may accept his party's nomination from the White House. I've been hearing more from our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan.
Well, in just under 2 weeks' time, there will be a Democratic convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but it will be a very scaled back affair. Only a handful of delegates will gather in person to formally nominate Joe Biden as the party's candidate for president. Most of the delegates and supporters have been told to stay away, and the bulk of the proceedings will happen online in what will be a virtual convention. Joe Biden, however, had been planning to deliver his acceptance speech in person in Wisconsin, but yesterday it was announced that that will not be happening. Instead, he will deliver his speech remotely from his home state of Delaware. Joe Biden's vice presidential pick, who is expected to be announced next week, will also deliver her speech remotely. So too will other big name speakers like Barack Obama. And this, I think, is very much a theme that we have seen from the Democrats and from the Biden campaign since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Joe Biden has barely left the basement of his home in Delaware. He does all his media interviews and campaign events from there. His fundraisers, his rallies, they're all virtual. Tonight, in fact, the campaign will host a virtual rally for Irish American voters. I think for Joe Biden, this low-key, almost invisible campaign is working for him. He is way ahead in the opinion polls. And remember, he's not the best debater. He's not the best media performer. So I think this low-key, out-of-the-spotlight strategy is working for him. It suits him. The Trump campaign, of course, is not very happy about this. Last night, they formally asked for an additional early presidential debate in order to get Joe Biden into the spotlight and to get him onto the campaign stage. Donald Trump, of course, has claimed that Joe Biden is suffering from some kind of cognitive decline, and the US president has boasted recently about passing a cognitive test himself. He's urging his Democratic opponent to take one too. Joe Biden was asked about this in his latest interview from his basement, which took place yesterday.
Have you taken a cognitive
test? No, I haven't taken a test. Why the hell would I take a test? Come on, man. That's like saying you, before you got in this program, if you take a test where you're taking cocaine or not, what do you think, huh? Are you a junkie?
What do you say to President Trump, who brags about his test and makes your mental state an issue for voters?
Well, if he can't figure out the difference between an elephant and a lion, I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
That's Joe Biden there. Well, Brian, the Republican convention has also been scaled back because of the coronavirus, and Donald Trump's suggestion that he may deliver his acceptance speech from the White House is attracting criticism.
Yeah, that's right, Audrey. As you say, the Republican convention scaled back as well, but it will go ahead. There will be a convention at the end of this month in North Carolina, but it will be far, far lower key than had been originally expected, much to the annoyance of Donald Trump. He had wanted a big rally-style convention, but authorities in North Carolina said no. So he moved his acceptance speech to Jacksonville, Florida, where he thought he would get a big rally packed with people. But again, that had to be cancelled because of coronavirus concerns. Then there was lots of speculation in recent weeks that maybe Donald Trump would make his nomination speech and his acceptance speech from a big iconic site like Mount Rushmore or Gettysburg. Lately, however, Donald Trump has been suggesting that he may deliver this speech from the White House, and that is quite controversial. At a press briefing last night, however, Donald Trump insisted he wouldn't be breaking the law if he did deliver his acceptance speech from the White House.
It is legal. There is no Hatch Act because it doesn't pertain to the president. But if I use the White House, we save tremendous amounts of money for the government in terms of security, traveling. If we go to another state or some other location, the amount of money is, you know, very enormous. So that's something to consider also.
President Donald Trump there. And separately last night, Facebook and Twitter both took action against what were described as misleading claims by the president about the coronavirus. What can you tell us, Brian?
Yeah, so this was an interview yesterday that Donald Trump gave to Fox News in which he claimed incorrectly that children were almost immune to the coronavirus. Now, that clip from that interview was posted on Donald Trump's Facebook page, but then it was taken down by Facebook because the company said it contained false claims and harmful COVID misinformation. Now, it is significant, Audrey, that Facebook took this action because it is the first time that that company has taken down a Trump post. And in fact, in the past, Facebook had been criticized for not being tougher on misleading claims that have been posted by the US president. The Trump campaign tweeted the same clip of Donald Trump talking about children being immune, and Twitter also took action last night. It froze the Twitter account of the Trump campaign until the post was removed. It's not the first time that Twitter has flagged or blocked Trump tweets for being in violation of its rules, but you may recall that in the past, when this has happened, Donald Trump has reacted furiously, claiming that social networks were trying to stifle free speech. Now, these latest actions by Twitter and Facebook happened quite late last night, so I think we can expect to see a less than pleased response from Donald Trump over the coming hours.
How will third level look when students return to campus in the autumn? Well, things are becoming clearer after the publication of guidelines for higher education institutions. Face coverings are being advised where 2 metre social distancing can't be maintained. There'll be changes to the way students come and go from lectures, and there'll be tighter rules about the use of on-campus accommodation. Kieran O'Hogartig, the president of NUI Galway, is on the line now to discuss this. Kieran, the big difference between colleges and universities and primary and secondary schools is you're dealing with thousands of people moving about and mixing on campus. What are the big changes you're going to have to make to ensure that's done safely?
Good morning, and morning to your listeners, and hope you're all well. Yes, I think there's a number of differences. One is the scale, and we're very, very conscious of our responsibility, not only to our staff and students in particular, but also to society at large. So really looking to open within public health guidelines, and certainly that's the priority, and as the guidelines issued yesterday clarify. So it will always be subject to public health guidelines, and the guidelines issued yesterday are guidance in that regard. A number of other differences, for example, our students are primarily adults. So again, there's that responsibility that is shared between us and our students. And I think that is also made clear in the guidelines. And we'll be making a lot of efforts in order to encourage students to behave in an appropriate manner, consistent with public health advice. And then thirdly, there are significant aspects in the guidelines around how teaching will take place and how the return to teaching will take place, but also guidelines around areas like accommodation, which again would be different between ourselves and other education providers. At higher education, we'd have accommodation on campus and students returning to accommodation off campus as well. So there are particular aspects of the guidance that we'll be taking into account in that regard.
So our students,
for example,
and staff,
capacity to teach and making teaching spaces safe. Also how access and egress is organised, and also making spaces available for students to self-isolate where necessary in accommodation. So part of this is really making now plans in this regard, and secondly, communicating to students and to society in general that the priority is public health and the health and safety of our students and staff, and therefore society in general.
So will students and staff return in full? And this report, it also puts an onus on institutions like yourselves to look at things that are normally beyond your control, like society events. Will there be RAG Week, for instance?
I think we'll be advising against that, or certainly in the context will provide us with guidance in that regard. And I think if it takes place, it will be quite different. And RAG Week is not a university event, as you say, so that's also challenging for us. But certainly we would be encouraging our students, noting that they are adults, to be responsible. And all events should take place in the context of public health advice in situ at that time. So, you know, that will also impact on clubs and societies and how they operate. A very important part of university life. And the guidance does set out, interestingly, that the most of that there is risk, obviously, in teaching spaces, and that risk needs to be managed and mitigated and minimized. But there's also risk, and more generally, outside of those spaces, and that's, I think, really where a lot of effort will take place in bringing students back to campus, is being conscious that we are part of society. Our walls are porous. The virus doesn't necessarily respect university walls, as we know, and therefore we really need to encourage behaviour which is consistent with public health advice and is responsible in that regard.
You mentioned campus accommodation. It's also an area of concern because these are congregated settings that we're hearing so much about. People share things like food preparation areas. How is this going to change?
Yeah, so we're planning around that and having accommodation maybe available in pods, so that students will have accommodation or be accommodated in pods where they're sharing those spaces. The guidance does have advice and requirements around, for example, access to accommodation only to those who are in that accommodation, encouragement not to share common spaces only to the extent necessary, and also making available self-isolation spaces. So we will be, as part of our capacity planning, both in the accommodation and more generally, making space available for students to self-isolate as necessary. And we'll be also encouraging other accommodation providers, as the guidance sets out, to do the same.
Okay, Ciarán Ó-Thógarthaig, President of NUI Galway, thank you for talking to us. It's 10 to 8.
You're welcome back to Morning Ireland at 8:09. It's time once again for the business news from Petula.
Thanks, Audrey. AIB has reported an underlying loss of €700 million for the first 6 months of the year. The bank has set aside €1.2 billion to cover potential loan losses. Colin Hunt is the bank's chief executive and is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Petula.
€1.2 billion to cover loan losses. That's much bigger than anticipated. How much of that is for actual loan losses and how much for expected loan losses?
The vast majority is actually related to expected credit losses, and it falls into three different buckets. Roughly 700 million of the 1.2 billion arises on foot of changes to our economic assumptions. We would have opened this year expecting growth in the Irish economy and the continuation of very low unemployment, effectively full employment. And of course, that's all changed now on the back of the COVID emergency. And we're now expecting the Irish economy will contract by 7.5% this year. So that drives an impairment of itself of the order of 700 million. There's an additional 400 million then coming from a deterioration in terms of credit grades as some of our larger customers and some of the majorly affected industries move lower through the stages. And then there's a management overlay of just in excess of 100 million as well, bringing us to a total of 1.2 billion. We think it's a comprehensive provision. We think it's a conservative and prudent provision, and we think it's very forward-looking, and it should substantially cover the expected credit impact from COVID-19 in 2020.
And do you expect to use up the full provision?
As I said, we expect it will substantially cover the credit charge for calendar 2020. Whether the full provision is used will depend on the evolution of the economy, not only in 2020, but also into 2021 and beyond, of course.
Okay. Your competitor, Bank of Ireland, announced yesterday that it's to reduce its workforce by 1,400 over the coming years. Is AIB planning job cuts?
Well, we have been reducing our headcount in recent years. And in fact, in the comparing June of this year with June of last year, our headcount is down by 6% and our staff costs are down by about 6%. We had planned a voluntary severance program for 2020. It was live when COVID hit. But once it was clear about the scale of the national and economic and societal crisis that we were facing, we decided to suspend our voluntary severance program. We took the approach that we needed all hands on deck at this time of grave crisis. Our bank has been operating at full capacity, putting payment breaks into the hands of our customers, and now beginning to focus on rebooting and supporting the recovery in the national economy.
How many of those payment breaks did AIB give to customers?
So the total number of payment breaks that we've issued has been 75,000. About 10,000 of those relate to our British business, and then about 65,000 in Ireland, the vast majority of which are in our retail banking operation, 64,000 payment breaks given to customers across our mortgage business, our personal business, and our small and medium-sized business.
And how many have gone back to full repayment?
So of the 64,000, 17,000 have gone back to full repayment. What we've seen of that 64,000, roughly half have now moved out of the initial 3 month payment break phase. And of that half, slightly above half have elected to return to full repayment of principal and interest, slightly less than half rolling on to a second 3 month payment break.
Okay. Colin Hunt, we'll leave it there. Time is against us. Chief Executive of AIB, thanks for talking to us this morning. I'll have more business news at 8:30. But for now, back to you, Samantha.
Summary, first of all, for the days ahead. Today will be mostly dry. And then we have rain moving into the west tonight. And that rain will spread across the country tomorrow. And then dry with sunshine for the weekend. And it'll also be coming quite warm as well. Now back to this morning. So it's quite nice out there at the moment, but cloud will steadily build through this morning and then becoming mostly cloudy in all areas by afternoon. Generally dry today, but there will be some light patchy rain or drizzle in southern counties through the late morning. And this drizzle will extend to western areas through the afternoon and evening. Rainfall amounts today will be quite small, and most areas will remain dry. Bright spells again in most areas by this evening. Highest temperatures today are for around 18 to 22 degrees, and it'll be warmest in the Midlands and north of the country. Winds will be moderate southerly and fresh to strong on coasts today. So a mild night tonight, with rain developing in the west, and this rain will extend to the western half of the country by tomorrow morning. Lows tonight are for around 13 to 15 degrees. So this patchy rain will spread from the west to all areas then later tomorrow morning. It will be most persistent in the west and north, where there will be some heavy bursts at times. The rain will then clear eastwards through the afternoon tomorrow. Good sunshine will follow for most areas for the afternoon and evening. Temperatures reaching around 19 degrees in the west tomorrow, 20 to 23 degrees elsewhere. Southerly winds again, moderate generally, but will be fresh on coast through the morning, and the winds will then veer westerly by tomorrow afternoon. So the weekend will be dry, sunny spells on both days, Saturday and Sunday, and temperatures in the low 20s, mid-20s even by the end of the weekend, and the winds will be quite light, so a pleasant weekend ahead. And then present indications are that it becomes more unsettled from Monday and into the early days of next week, with showers moving in from the east. And that's the forecast. Good morning.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, August the 6th, and this is Morning Ireland with Samantha Labreri and Audrey Carville. The news is read now by Brian Jennings.
A report published today recommends that anonymity should be granted to those accused of all sexual offences, not just rape, until they are convicted. The Review of Protections for Vulnerable Witnesses in Sexual Offences Cases, chaired by law lecturer and barrister Tom O'Malley, also recommends that all victims of sexual offences should have the opportunity to receive free legal advice. The working group to look at the law here was set up after the high-profile trial in Belfast in 2018, in which rugby players Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olding were acquitted of rape. Our legal affairs correspondent, Orla O'Donnell.
This working group recommends anonymity should be extended to those accused of sexual assault as well as rape. It says there doesn't appear to be any logical reason why accused people should be entitled to anonymity in a rape trial but not in a sexual assault trial. It also recommends the public should be excluded from trials of all sexual offences. Consideration should be given, it says, to giving anonymity to people charged with offences involving child sexual exploitation. But it says the case for not naming those charged with what are called child pornography offences isn't strong and would raise questions about how many other offences should be treated in a similar way. The report recommends all victims of sexual offences should have the opportunity to receive free legal advice if they want it, but it does not favour separate legal representation for victims for the duration of a trial. It says there should be a public education programme to educate people about consent, and it says there should be more information and support for victims, as well as training for Gardaí, judges and lawyers.
3 days of national mourning have begun in Lebanon following the devastating chemical explosion in the capital Beirut on Tuesday. International assistance has started to arrive, including search teams, doctors and equipment. The French President Emmanuel Macron is due to visit the city today. The blast killed at least 135 people, injured more than 5,000, and left tens of thousands homeless. Some of the city's hospitals are damaged or only partially operational. Students at third-level institutions will be advised to wear face coverings if they cannot maintain a distance of 2 metres during lectures, according to new recommendations from the government. The Department of Further and Higher Education says there are circumstances where maintaining a distance of 2 metres will not be possible. Cillian Sherlock reports.
The government advises higher education institutions to develop one-way systems for indoor spaces or use marked lanes where practical. Third-level students are asked not to enter accommodation buildings they do not live in and to not arrive on campus if they have symptoms. There is a requirement for space to be identified on campus that will allow people who develop symptoms to wait safely away from others. There may be an additional requirement for alternate residential space for students who are self-isolating. The guidelines acknowledge that some learning will take place online, but where 2 metre distance is not possible for tuition, staff members should wear face shields or visors. Group work across the semester should also be rostered into pods to minimise mixing of people.
Twitter has banned US President Donald Trump's re-election campaign account from tweeting again until it removes a video post containing what it says is misinformation about coronavirus. Earlier, Facebook removed the video from Mr. Trump's personal page on its site, saying it violated its policies. The post contained an excerpt from an interview in which Mr. Trump said that children were almost immune to COVID-19. A ceremony has been held in the Japanese city of Hiroshima, marking 75 years since the world's first atomic bomb attack. The US World War II bomb killed around 140,000 people, many instantly, with others dying in the weeks and months that followed. The coronavirus pandemic led to a scaled-back event this year. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres sent a video message.
75 years ago, a single nuclear weapon brought unspeakable death and destruction upon this city. The effects linger to this day. The city and its people, however, have chosen not to be characterized by calamity, but instead by resilience, reconciliation and hope. As unmatched advocates for nuclear disarmament, the Hibakush have turned their tragedy into a rallying voice for the safety and well-being of all humanity.
Now the time is coming up to 6 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather, sponsored by SuperValu. Our online shopping delivers value straight to your front door. It's got to be SuperValu.
A dry start with sunny spells. Cloud will build from the south through the morning, becoming mostly cloudy in all areas by afternoon. Generally dry today, but there will be some light, patchy rain or drizzle in the south and west. Highest temperatures 18 to 22 degrees, warmest in the north.
The Irish Independent publishes details of a briefing document for the new Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, which predicts that massive backlogs for basic treatment and diminished cancer services will be left in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. Cormac McQuinn reports that the 209-page briefing contains a warning that patient waiting lists will increase by as much as 130%, and it predicts a €180 million shortfall in funding for the National Children's Hospital. The paper also reports that college students will have to wear face coverings in lecture halls if 2 metre separation between students isn't possible. The number of students in a lecture hall at any one time, we're told, will be 50, as college lectures have the same status as any indoor public event. The Irish Times gives front page coverage to the heavy toll that COVID-19 has taken on Ireland's economy, as revealed in the latest Exchequer figures, which show it punched an €8.3 billion hole in the public finances. The paper says some ministers have privately expressed concern about the Cabinet's response to the pandemic and have questioned the messaging coming from the Department of the Taoiseach, particularly in relation to the reopening of pubs. Two tests for all tourists is the Irish Daily Mail's lead headline. In an interim report, the Oireachtas Committee on COVID-19 recommends that all overseas visitors who come into the country be tested at least twice during their stay in Ireland. What's believed to be Ireland's first drive-through confirmation took place in County Limerick yesterday, and it's covered in the Irish Daily Mirror. The original plan of an open-air ceremony had to be abandoned due to the heavy rain, so Father Roy Donovan donned waterproof gear over his vestments to preside over the lunchtime ceremony in the car park of Caroline Church. There's extensive coverage in words and in pictures of the funeral of John Hume, which was attended by the President and the Taoiseach. Senna Maloney in The Independent describes how the maiden city mourned John Hume with dignity and solemnity. The Times gives prominence to the comments of Chief Celebrant Father Paul Farran, who told mourners that when the history of Ireland is written, if Pat Hume's name is not beside John's, it will be an incomplete history. Pat encircled John with love, compassion and support, he said. The front page photo in the Belfast Telegraph shows mourners applauding along the roadside in the rain as the funeral cortege passes, while Alison Morris in the Irish News writes that the miserable weather reflected the mood of a city, a place he loved so well and that equally loved him back. The death of a teenager yesterday in a fall at Powerscourt Waterfall in County Wicklow is covered on the front of the Irish Daily Star. The 15-year-old was on holidays with his parents and Gardaí say it was a tragic accident. The lead story for the Herald is that the families of the Stardust victims have said they're elated that inquests into the deaths of 48 people in the 1981 disco fire are to begin in Dublin Castle early next year. According to the Irish Examiner, a number of Green Party TDs are considering at what point they will walk away from coalition government. Sources within the party suggest that TDs who are unhappy voting on certain legislation have been telling colleagues that they are biding their time. And major excavations on Spike Island in Cork Harbour have uncovered a tunnel and a previously unknown spiral staircase, which are believed to have been part of a fort built there in the 1790s. The Irish Farmers Journal reports that the beef and sheep processing lines at Kildare Chilling have been suspended following a COVID outbreak. One Carlow sheep farmer described the suspension as a terrible blow to the farming community, while another farmer said he had been turned away from the factory on Tuesday with 50 lambs. Also in the journal, organisers of the scaled-down National Ploughing Championships are to limit the gathering to 200 people in line with public health guidelines. Anna-Marie McHugh stressed the event wouldn't be open to the general public, but she did convey the welcome news that the brown bread baking competition would still be going ahead.
In 2018, a high-profile 9-week rape trial took place in Belfast involving a young woman and 4 men, including the then Ulster rugby players Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olding. All 4 defendants were found not guilty on all charges, but the publicity and discussion surrounding the trial led to 2 reviews of how the judicial system deals with serious sexual assault cases. The first of these reviews focused on the Northern Ireland judicial system and provided more than 250 recommendations. The second of these reviews focused on the Republic's judicial system, and that's been published today. It makes 50 recommendations on how the judicial system could change. And to discuss that in more detail, Helen McEntee, the Minister for Justice, is here in studio. Yeah. Minister, the issue of anonymity was one that there was much debate about in the wake of the Belfast rape trial. Now, the rules in Northern Ireland are different, and here there is anonymity for the complainant and the accused unless convicted. But what this review recommends, some changes in this regard. Can you talk us through those?
It does, and as you've outlined, this is a report that really followed on from what was a very high profile case where there was concern around the experiences, in particular vulnerable witnesses, but also Tom O'Malley, who was the author of this report, was asked to look at the experiences of vulnerable witnesses going through investigations and prosecutions for sexual offences. And I think the report is very welcome. It very positively and very much so focuses on the victims here and making sure that we can put in place a system whereby victims of sexual assault, victims of sexual crimes, know what information is available to them, supports that are available to them, but most importantly, that if they come forward, that they will be listened to, that they will be heard, that they will be treated with respect and dignity, and that they will be supported through what is a very difficult process. It's also important that we get to a point whereby somebody who commits a sexual crime knows that they will be reported, because we will support the victim to do so, that they will be investigated and they will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. And these recommendations, I think, go a long way in helping us get to that point, and it's important now that we move to implement them. The specific point that you've outlined there, and I think we have to go back to the fact that, yes, there are different jurisdictions here and there are different measures in place, and if this trial had taken place in the in this jurisdiction, we maybe wouldn't have seen or heard of a lot of what happened or went on. But we have to remember, and the very cornerstone of our justice system is that you are innocent until proven guilty. And we have a situation whereby if somebody is accused of rape, the anonymity applies not just to the victim, but also to the defendant. And I think what the recommendation here is suggesting is that victims of sexual assault, and if you look at aggravated assault, it carries the same penalty if found guilty as rape. There is that same social stigma attached to somebody. And we've seen again in recent times where somebody has been accused of sexual assault, later acquitted, and obviously that stigma follows them. So the recommendation is that this would be extended not just to that it remains at rape, but would be extended to sexual assault. But again, this is a recommendation. This is something that I have to, and working with the various different NGOs, with the various different stakeholders, have to reflect on. And my plan is over the next 10 weeks that we will put in place a very clear implementation plan, taking on board the recommendations, taking on board the views of victims groups, NGOs, the legal profession, the judiciary, and indeed colleagues of mine who I'll work with as well, to put in place a plan to implement these recommendations.
So how long before people would see a difference in the court settle?
Well, there are some recommendations in saying that I hope to move on very quickly. So working on legislation to introduce what would be a preliminary trial hearing. One of the biggest concerns that we've heard from the various different victims groups is the delays that consistently happen in actually getting to trial, and what the preliminary trial hearing would do is hopefully address a lot of the concerns and agree a lot of areas before it even gets to trial. We also want to look at, and this is an area that has already progressed, introducing and making sure that we have all of the specialist divisional units for the Garda Síochána in place. 17 out of the 27 are currently there, and we are hoping to have the remainder of those in place by September. There's also a recommendation, but one that I will act on immediately with my colleague in Minister in Higher Education, a recommendation around education, particularly focusing on consent, not just in our schools and universities, but a more general basis. Then there are obviously, as you mentioned, 50 recommendations focusing on everything from training with An Garda Síochána, the legal profession, the judiciary, to make sure that from the very outset, from the moment a vulnerable witness or a victim comes into contact with somebody, that they are in a position to support them, that they know the information, that the legal support that's available to them, and that they can work with them and support them throughout this entire process. So there's a lot of things we can move on immediately. There's some that will require legislation, some will require funding, and I think maybe just to point on one specific area, and this is something that has been called for, and this is around legal support and advice for vulnerable victims. What I hope to do is immediately engage with the Legal Aid Board, and what we hope to set out based on the recommendations from Tom O'Malley is a system whereby from the very outset a victim of a sexual crime or a vulnerable witness can have access to legal advice, because what we've actually found is that there's a huge amount of legislation, there's a huge amount of information there, but it's not all available, it's not all known. We need to pull it together to put it into a single portal so that anybody can access it, but most importantly the people who need it most are the vulnerable witnesses.
Can I ask you about another issue that's part of your brief, the issue of direct provision? NPHET have expressed concern about the number of outbreaks of COVID-19 in these settings. There's been 20 21 involving 235 people. Five of those were told remain an issue. There's been four new clusters involving 47 new cases in recent weeks. What are you doing to tackle this?
So we know that there has been an increase in recent days, and I think positively we've been able to identify, because of the increased and the very targeted way in which we are now testing and contact tracing, we know where they have come from. We know, I suppose, the workplace where a lot of it has originated from, and we have moved to isolate and to ensure that those who have tested positive, but also those who have come in close contact with them, have been able to self-isolate as well. From the very outset, and I suppose it's important to say that we have, and my Department and Justice have always worked with the HSE, with NEFIT, with the Department of Health to put in place measures that will protect people in direct provision. We have identified 850 beds throughout this entire process, which has allowed us, where necessary, to allow people to self-isolate, people over 65 in direct provision to be able to self-isolate, those who have underlying conditions or health requirements that need to do so. But we've also tried to make sure, and we have made sure that within the direct provision centres information is available, that it's translated where necessary as well, but that in the same way that I am and you are being asked to adhere to public health guidelines, to socially distance, to apply the same type of public health guidelines, that information has been getting across as well. But obviously, look, we are very conscious that there has been a number of clusters and outbreaks, but we have moved very quickly to support and to work with these people and to try and make sure that they can isolate as quickly as possible.
And we heard from Masai earlier in the programme, who were talking about the difficulties of isolation. They're saying, you know, while there is the facility for people to go, they still have to come back to very cramped and crowded conditions. As the winter progresses, as the numbers rise, are you concerned, or are you looking at other ways of accommodating people in the shorter term?
Well, this, I think, moves into the much broader picture and the larger question around direct provision. And obviously there is a commitment in the programme for government to move away from that type of system. We obviously have a lot of people in emergency accommodation at the moment as well. I suppose the objective is to try and remove them from emergency accommodation as quickly as possible, that people, where possible, can be in their own accommodation, turnkey accommodation, where they, you have family units that can live independently, where they can access their own home through their own door, where they're not sharing rooms.
But that's,
and
in
this
the long
is the
term,
type of system.
Short term, what can we do?
Well, we have been moving to remove people from emergency accommodation in recent weeks, and we'll continue to do so moving into the winter as well. But it's important to understand that we're not going to be able to remove direct provision centres overnight or by the end of this year or by Christmas as we come into the winter, as you say. So what we are doing is working with public health officials to make sure that the correct measures are put in place so that people can socially distance, that they can isolate, and that absolutely where necessary that they can be moved if that's what required.
NEFIT wants fortnightly testing for people living in direct provision. Will that happen across the board?
Well, we've seen how we've been able to increase our testing capacity over the last number of months, and we have always been guided by NEFIT and by the public health officials, so we will work with them, of course, if this is something that they're recommending.
We've heard stories of people who've availed of the isolation areas, particularly people who live in healthcare, or sorry, who work in healthcare, who've needed to isolate for those reasons, people who are medically vulnerable, going to another accommodation, but still having to return for things like washing and food and that kind of thing. Has that issue been resolved?
Well, again, I'm very conscious that this is a very difficult situation, and, direct provision in itself is not the type of system that we want to remain, and this is why we're moving to abolish it essentially. And I know my colleague Minister O'Gorman Roderick, who will be taking over the provision of direct provision in the coming weeks and months, is very keen to do so as quickly as possible. We are trying to put in place as many supports as possible to protect people currently in direct provision, in the same way that we are trying to put in place measures to support people on a national basis as well. And this includes making sure that they feel safe, and that obviously where they need to isolate that they can do so without having to put themselves at harm's
risk. Many of those isolation rooms that we've heard about are in the City West accommodation. The contract runs out with the government and City West in October. Is there a plan beyond that?
Well, certainly if this is something that we need to extend, we will be engaging with them. But, we have made every attempt to put in place safe and secure measures for people in direct provision. consumption. And as we've seen with the measures that we've extended in other areas beyond October, this is certainly something if we need to do, we will absolutely do.
OK, Minister for Justice Helen McEntee, thank you for joining us.
Growing and significant concerns, that's how the Acting Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, described the current thinking among the National Public Health Emergency Team in a letter to the Health Minister this week. Specifically, he's concerned at the increasing number of daily cases, the growing numbers in vulnerable groups like those in direct provision, multiple outbreaks in work areas like construction and food production, the growing numbers among young people, and the spread of the virus across the country. All this led to NPHET advising the government not to proceed with phase four of the easing of restrictions next week, the main one being the continued closure of all pubs. We are joined now by Professor Mary Horgan, consultant in infectious diseases at Cork University Hospital and president of the Royal College of Physicians. Professor Horgan, thank you for joining us this morning. If the case numbers continue to rise, there were 50 confirmed cases yesterday, can you envisage a reversal of some of the measures from phase three when most businesses and services were allowed to resume?
No, I don't see a reversal of those decisions. If you look at the cases most recently, most of them were associated with clusters. And I think what it highlights is the importance of testing and tracing and how the capacity and expertise of the public health doctors and the contact tracers have really been put to test. We know it really works, and the numbers are a reflection of the good work that they're doing. So while we individually and as communities adhere to public health guidance, as the hand hygiene, the face masks, the other key element is testing, and it's test, test, test. We see an increasing number of cases outside Dublin, and it probably highlights the need for regional leads who are accountable for managing the testing and tracing and really containing the virus and suppressing it, as we've seen in recent days.
So do you not share Dr. Glynn's concerns about the multiple outbreaks in work areas like construction and food production and just the increasing number of cases every day?
Well, that, I suppose that was inevitable. It was going to happen once we opened up the country, which was absolutely necessary. It was absolutely necessary for our economy, for our society, for us to be able to live. We absolutely have to live with this virus. It's going to be around certainly until 2021, until we have a vaccine, an effective and safe vaccine available to us. So we can't live in a state of paralysis. The country does need to open up. And when the phase three was opened up at the end of June, it was the right decision at the right time. We needed to see how the virus was going to circulate, particularly during the summer months, and to ensure that our test and trace strategy was really up to par, which clearly it is. Of course, we it would be great to see no cases, but as an infectious disease doctor, I can tell you, with this particular virus, it's unlikely that we will get total eradication of it without a vaccine. So it's very much the two fundamentals of the of all of us adhering to public health guidance, and then the health service doing test and tracing very efficiently, probably by region, so it can really contain the virus where it's happening, particularly in workplaces.
Yeah, and we've seen localised lockdowns across the water in Britain. Aberdeen, the most recent city to go into lockdown, Leicester a few weeks previously. Is something like that feasible here, where some counties would have restrictions and others don't? Or is the country, as we know, just too small for that?
Well, it is a smaller country, and our population density is much, much lower than it is in the UK. And I think we should all be grateful for the low density relative in most parts of the country compared to many other countries, particularly in Europe and in Southeast Asia. So that's a huge benefit to the population here. Yes, that is feasible, that, you know, you can have very regional lockdowns. We've seen it with some of the food processing and factories and building sites where they did just lock down those and very effectively. And that may be what needs to happen. And if you do it at a regional level and have very good control at a regional level, then the chances of having a national lockdown again is extremely low. And I don't think that would be good for society or indeed the economy, which underpins how we are able to live. We heard earlier from NUIG about learning, mm-hmm. about playing sport, about us viewing sports too. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of all the things that we do. It's not just one thing. It's some of them all.
And I think many people perhaps may be confused about the reasons for some things and not for others. You mentioned sport there. It's hard for people to understand why they can play contact sport, but they can't watch it in bigger numbers than a couple of hundred in a big ground. It's hard for people to explain why a pub that serves a burger can reopen, but one that doesn't can't, when both are implementing the same COVID safety measures.
Well, when it comes to sports, I mean, sports are predominantly played outdoors. Certainly the team sports like rugby, hockey and all of the Gaelic games. And the risk with outdoor activity is much, much lower. Likewise, with spectators watching outdoors, assuming they adhere to the social distancing and wearing face masks, are at relatively lower risk. It's the three C's, which is big crowds, it's too many close contacts and closed environments. And I suppose the fourth C is a bit of common sense around all of the things that we need to do.
If cases keep rising and Dr. Glynn and Neffat continue to have their growing concerns, do you believe schools should reopen at the end of this month?
Well, I believe schools reopen. Our young people and our children do need to get back to school. And the Secretary General of the UN even produced a paper about saving our future. And they are our future. School is important for so many reasons. And I'm delighted that the Taoiseach and the Minister for Health and Education have that as a priority, getting our young people back into education.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Professor Mary Horgan, Consultant in Infectious Diseases at Cork University Hospital and President of the Royal College of Physicians.
AIB has set aside €1.2 billion to cover potential loan losses due to the economic impact across all portfolios caused by COVID-19. The bank reported an underlying loss of €700 million for the first 6 months of the year. AIB is announcing a €300 million social housing fund for the provision of 2,000 new social houses. KBC Ireland has set aside €95 million to deal with problem loans, reflecting what Chief Executive Peter Robin described as an extremely challenging economic environment. The bank reported a loss of €55 million for the second quarter of the year. Bord BS says a fall in food and drink exports of €126 million so far this year shows the impact of the pandemic on international trade. This is on the back of a decade of record growth, which saw €13 billion in food and drink exports last year. Bord BS has designed supports to assist producers mitigate against the impact on trade. On the currencies, €1 buys 90 pence sterling and $1 19 cents.
Now at 24 minutes to 9, Darren Frettel is back with sports news. And Darren, there's some breaking news from the FAI.
There is never a dull day when it comes to Irish soccer, Samantha, and another twist in the ongoing saga of the FAI's road to recovery. Late last night, the elected directors of the association issued a statement. They issued a statement independent of the game's governing body, and it doesn't make good reading for interim CEO Gary Owens. Our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue, who joins me on the line. What can you tell us about the contents of the statement, Tony?
Yeah, well, the unrest within the FAI continued late last night after the 8 football directors released a statement calling on the association's interim CEO Gary Owens to clarify remarks he made at a press briefing on Wednesday. During that press conference, Mr. Owens refuted a claim made by Fianna Fáil Deputy Mark McSharry that a memorandum of understanding with the government that was signed on the 30th of January without it being discussed at a board meeting earlier that day. Mr. Owens claimed that the board members had the opportunity to review what the terms and conditions were and that they did sign off on it. They didn't sign off on it afterwards, they signed off on it beforehand. McSharry is wrong on that, he said. Well, the elected directors late last night stated that on the record they did not approve the memorandum of understanding before it was signed. Therefore, Mr. McSharry's statement is correct. The facts are that they only received a draft copy at 9:02 a.m. on the 30th of January and immediately raised concerns regarding some of the conditions with the chairman, and they received no reply. The elected directors, all from the football constituency, as I say, called on the interim CEO to immediately clarify his remarks. Now, this is quite significant because yesterday, Gary Owens and Niall Quinn were basically telling the wider football community that the memorandum of understanding, which is basically enabled a bailout of the cash-strapped FAI, has to be approved by their EGM, and that EGM has been called for the 31st of August. Next Friday at the Red Cow, all the National Council members are coming together. So it was a question of selling this to the membership, but this is another very serious obstacle in the road, I'm afraid. The infighting continues. It seems it's never-ending at the FAI.
Never ending, never a truer word. Tony O'Donoghue, thanks for that update. David McGoldrick has been named the Player of the Year at the FAI Awards, sponsored by Three. Later today, the Gaelic Players Association will release new figures to highlight a significant rise in the number of players seeking help and support during the COVID-19 pandemic. Damien Lawler has more.
Last week, the GPA reported that almost 1,500 players had been supported by them in 2019. New figures to be released today show that 629 players have already contacted the association for help this year. That's an 8% increase on the period of last year. And Antrim hurler Neil McManus was one of those who saw support, and he says the figures reflect the work that the GPA is putting in with players.
Mental health is an area where so many players have received help, and these are past and present inter-county players. A lot of people view them as invincible young adults, and this isn't the case at all. We're more than aware that people and players of our games throughout our communities in Ireland are alive today because of the services that are afforded to them through the GPA.
Much of the talk from last week's GPA's annual report centred on wages for top staff and how almost €450,000 in combined salaries was shared among key personnel. There was also much debate on the GPA's image and why it is negatively perceived by some. McManus, however, says that people need to see the full picture before they comment.
Most people are poorly informed about the GPA and what support is provided until they receive a first-hand account from a member of their own community. Rather than, you know, basing their opinion solely on a few negative column inches that they've read on a Sunday. I know personally the GPA services have had a massively positive impact on my development, and this is benefiting my community as a consequence. And not alone in Cushion Dole, but this is the case throughout Ireland, everywhere that the GAA is living and breathing.
Neil McManus there speaking with Damien Lawler. The USPGA Championship gets underway later today. There was a period during the lockdown when we thought there wouldn't be a golf major this year. There is, albeit a little different. I've been talking to Greg Allen about two of our leading contenders, Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy.
It's really hard to know what to expect, although we have seen on the PGA Tour that golf without spectators kind of works. But for the players, it is difficult. Rory McIlroy has admitted that this is a really difficult environment for him because he would be one of those players who would have very large galleries following him, and he feeds off the energy of those galleries. And there's no doubt that McIlroy probably suffered more than most. But look, other players have got on with it. We've seen Justin Thomas win at the weekend for his third victory of the season. He is now the rightful world number one. He is the form player in the field. But the man who ran him so close in Memphis, in that World Golf Championship event last week, Brooks Koepka, he's just the consummate majors player. He's had four victories since 2016 in majors. He's had five other top six finishes. And he, alongside Thomas, are justifiably the favourites. And McIlroy is flying under the radar. And that might be no bad thing as he seeks to win a first major golf championship in, what now, six years since 2014, since he won the USPGA. So McIlroy definitely has a chance, but not among the favourites for a change.
Well, Greg, it's the first major to be staged since Portrush last July, 12 months ago. Any chance of back-to-back major wins for the man from Clara?
Well, really, actually, Shane Lowry has a real chance, and I think that's because of last week's performance. He finished sixth in that World Golf Championship event in Memphis. That was his best performance on the PGA Tour since winning the Open Championship over a year ago. And he's paired with Gary Woodland, the US Open champion, and Koepka, the reigning US PGA champion, so he'll feel like he's a real contender.
Stephanie Meadow also in action in America, in Ohio, and finally there's racing at Leopardstown today from 1 o'clock.
And Lebanon has begun 3 days of national mourning following this week's explosion in the capital Beirut. Almost 3,000 tonnes of ammonium nitrate, which had been stored for 6 years at the city's port, blew up, killing at least 137 people. Dozens are missing, thousands are injured, hundreds of thousands are homeless. The scene is devastating. We can talk now to Catherine Wybrow, Lebanon country lead for Concern Worldwide. Catherine, what are you doing there at the moment?
I'm sorry, I missed that question. It must be the connection.
That's okay. There is a slight delay on the line. I was just wondering what your work is involved at the moment. What are you doing there?
Well, Concern Worldwide has been in operational in Lebanon since 2013. And our activities have very much evolved alongside the Syrian crisis. As it changes, we change. So what we've started with was emergency shelter and emergency water and sanitation. And we've continued that up until today. Then as the crisis became more protracted, we focused on education, specifically non-formal education and protection needs. So addressing issues such as sexual and gender-based violence, as well as child protection, and case management for particularly vulnerable individuals.
I suppose in relation to the explosion this week and the aftermath of it, what are you doing? How are you trying to help?
Well, at this stage, we're still in the first 48 hours of the incident occurring. So in this initial period, the focus needs to be on life-saving measures. So at the moment, under the coordination of the government of Lebanon, the focus is on search and rescue and also on first aid, including psychological first aid. Simultaneously, the government, in coordination with the UN and other NGOs, including ourselves, of course, is coordinating a rapid needs assessment to identify what is needed in other areas. Now, because Concern has the strongest added value and capabilities in the area of shelter, particularly housing rehabilitation, protection, so psychosocial support and case management, water and sanitation, if there are gaps identified in these areas, we are ready to jump in and help. However, there's a huge risk of duplication here. We don't want 20 agencies running in and all providing water, for example, particularly if there's no need. So we're in the process of waiting for the government rapid needs assessment. Then once we narrow it down, we will participate in a joint needs assessment with other humanitarian agencies. And once those needs are identified, we're ready to jump in those particular sectors.
And international aid is starting to arrive. There are calls for it not to be routed through the Lebanese government because there are growing complaints of corruption. Can you get it without it going through that route?
Yes, this is ultimately the decision of the donor country, whether or not it goes, which mechanism it goes through. However, Concern has received funding from bilateral countries, bilateral governments, but also through UN mechanisms. So ultimately, how the money is channeled to respond to this incident, this disaster, will be up to the donors themselves.
Okay, well, thank you very much and the best of luck with your work there. Catherine Wybrow, Lebanon country lead for Concern Worldwide. Now, we know that the COVID-19 pandemic has put unprecedented pressure on our health service. What impact will it have on the hundreds of thousands of everyday procedures that patients undergo in hospital and for the more serious treatments for diseases like cancer when our health service gets back up and running? like it was pre-COVID-19. Well, the Irish Independent has seen a briefing document prepared for government, and its headline in the paper this morning calls it a disaster. Its political correspondent, Cormac McQuinn, has the story and he joins us now. Cormac, just tell us a little bit more about this briefing document.
Well, at the beginning of every new government, new ministers are all given briefing documents. Now, the Department of Health is renowned as a difficult portfolio to get, and the briefing for the new health minister, Stephen Donnelly, makes for particularly grim reading. So it's about 200 pages long. It outlines lots of the challenges facing the health system, which were, some pre-existed COVID-19 and some have been exacerbated or brought on by the global pandemic. So some of the headline pieces in the briefing are warnings about waiting lists soaring by the end of the year. The officials outline a scenario where if the HSE operations are only running at 50% and the National Treatment Purchase Fund is running at full capacity, we would have a scenario where some waiting lists could grow by as much as 130%. Inpatient and day case waiting lists could grow by 83%, leaving 121,000 people on the waiting list by the end of the year. Gastrointestinal scopes could increase by 130%, leaving 51,000 people on the waiting list at the end of the year. And outpatient waiting lists could grow 40% from 553,000 to 776,000. So they're very stark figures from waiting lists which weren't short to begin with, but that there is the impact of COVID-19. And remember, that's a scenario where the health service would be, the HSE operations would be at 50%, and the officials warned that at present, when this document was drawn up in June, the operations were significantly below 50%. There's also a warning that additional funding will be needed by the end of the year, so that the health service has already seen a boost for funding solely due to the COVID-19 crisis of 2 billion euro. The officials warn that this could be a further 1 billion euro by the end of the year to deal with the costs of fighting the virus.
And Cormac, what is the situation for cancer care and treatment? Because that continued for cancer patients during the pandemic. But what's this briefing document saying about the future of that?
Well, the health department officials say that there's a section called the challenges of a new normal for cancer care, and again the figures are quite stark. They talk about how the throughput of cancer services is at a lower rate overall than it would have been in the pre-COVID-19 norm. So medical oncology is at about 70%, radiation oncology 80%, and surgeries it's about 50%. There's quite a stark warning that it will not be possible to get the numbers back where they were while implementing physical distancing and associated precautionary measures without further space and resources for hospitals. So what hospitals have been asked to do, the hospital groups have been asked to contact the department and suggest ways that they could increase their space, resources that they'll need. Key section of that bit, those where these are feasible. So they've already begun making those applications to the department, but again it will depend on the budget that's available to the Department of Health whether these things can go ahead.
And the Children's Hospital, the National Children's Hospital, might need even more money.
Yeah, this was in an unredacted section of the document actually, but it's quite a concerning section as well. The document talks about how there's a shortfall of 180 million in terms of the additional cash required to meet the increased costs of National Children's Hospital over the years 2020 to 2022. They say it will need to be funded from within the existing health capital allocation, as we know, due to COVID-19 and the pre-existing pressures of health. The capital allocation of health is always there's lots of calls for use of that funding. So the department is going to have to figure out a way of paying that 180 million as the Children's Hospital project proceeds.
Okay, Cormac, thank you very much. Cormac McQuinn there of the Irish Independent. The Department of Health, in a statement, said that one of the most pressing tasks is to resume the operation of health and social care services in light of a much reduced level of COVID-19, and capacity in those services will be reduced and demand is likely to be higher than normal, both because elective activity was postponed during the crisis and because demand for many services may be higher than it was pre-COVID-19. It's 6 minutes to 9.
Leave No Trace, that's the name of a new government campaign to tackle the growing issue of litter throughout the country. Some of our most scenic locations have become litter hotspots, with a particular problem being noticed since COVID-19 restrictions eased. Maura Kiley is the CEO of the Leave No Trace Ireland, and she's on the line. Maura, thanks for talking to us this morning. Tell us a bit more about the issues you're seeing.
Good morning. So there's been an increased number of people visiting the outdoors since COVID-19. And I just want to say that this is absolutely brilliant. We live in a beautiful countryside and we really want to see people enjoying the outdoors, but doing it responsibly. But really, since the increase of people visiting the outdoors, we've seen the increase of littering. And this campaign, Love This Place, Leave No Trace, is calling on everybody to take care for our countryside and to bring their rubbish home. So there's been lots of different types of litter. Really, we're seeing new groups of youths going out into the outdoors and socialising the outdoors. Lots of families going outside and having picnics. And the litter that's left behind is really unsightly. It's detrimental to wildlife and the environment. It can take an aluminium can for nearly 500 years to break down, a plastic bag 20 years. So that's really harmful to the wildlife, to the environment and the local communities that live there.
Is a lack of bins an issue? And it's a servicing of these bins, you'll often see in busy spots full bins by early afternoon.
When we're in the outdoor spaces, people often ask, why aren't there more bins? But actually our research and international research would say that putting bins in these places actually increases the problem. So our approach with the Government of Ireland is all about inspiring people to do the right thing through education. And that is a much better long-term solution to this problem.
Are there particular areas that you're seeing particular problems?
Yes, it's not just in the typical areas of Dublin Mountains or the Wicklow. We're seeing them right across the countryside in all of our national parks, our nature reserves, our woodlands, the OPW heritage sites, our waterways, the beaches, all which are special areas of conservation. So it's happening all around the countryside.
And you're seeing a bigger problem since COVID-19 restrictions eased. Is that because more people are out and about and using these facilities than were before?
That's right. Yes, people are having staycations at home, but also because the pubs and the normal places people would socialise are closed, they're going to these places to socialise. So that's why this particular issue is, there's a particular surge in littering throughout the countryside in the recent number of weeks.
And disposable barbecues, are they a particular problem?
They're a particular problem and they're not permitted in national park sites or OPW sites. So we ask people to avoid them. If they do want to have a barbecue or to go out, to bring that barbecue home with them.
Okay, Maura Kiley, CEO of Leave No Trace Ireland. Thank you. It's 2 minutes to 9.